Okay, thanks for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. As Fred pointed out, I'm an experimentalist, but I see our field in the long term move more and more into a situation where we can make sense of our data only within good theoretical frameworks. And by this, I mean not only methods to analyze data, but also theory to guide our thinking about the nervous system. So I'm grateful that I can come and learn more about theory. And we have recently taken a venture into a little bit of theory, as Fred mentioned. In fact, to correct you, a physicist was involved, but he's actually faculty in the mathematics department, applied mathematics. And most of the work was actually done by a real mathematician here. So we'll come to that. But my contribution was minimal here. Anyway, I'm going to discuss that. So the question that we are interested in is the computations that the brain performs at a level that is above the single neuron. So we would like to know how neuronal circuits process information in a way that you cannot figure out by studying one neuron at a time. So in order to look at the function of neuronal circuits, we also need experimentally a variety of methods that go beyond single neuron recordings. We would first of all like to measure the activity from as many neurons as we can within the intact circuit. And at some point, we of course also need to know the connectivity between the same neurons that we measured the activity from. And I will focus today on our main model system, which is the olfactory system. Just a brief overview. Most of the data I will present are from the olfactory bulb, which is the first processing stage in the brain. It receives direct input from sensory neurons in the nose, and the output is conveyed to various regions in the telencephalon, including olfactory cortex, and those connections are usually bidirectional. So, coming to the topic of measuring activity patterns and connectivity patterns, there are a couple of methods that came up recently and that we are using also. But those methods all basically have size limitations. So using two-photon calcium imaging, I will show you examples. It's now possible to record from calcium signals from a few thousand neurons or so in an intact brain. But going beyond this limit of a few thousand or so will become quite difficult. Connectivity can, in principle, be reconstructed by three-dimensional electron microscopy, but this is also size-limited, not so much for technical reasons, but for time reasons, because it takes forever to acquire those stacks, and also because the reconstruction of the neurons within these 3D data sets are an enormous task. I think you've heard about this in the first week of this workshop here. So in order to deal with these size limitations, our way out of this dilemma is to just use a small animal as a model system, and that is for us the zebrafish. So in adult zebrafish, even the olfactory bulb is actually quite small. And for recording purposes, it has the advantage that we can take out the brain and keep it in vitro for half a day minimum, and then sort of combine methods of systems neuroscience with methods of cellular neuroscience, such as targeted patch clamping under visual control and so on. And many people, including us a little bit, also work on these zebrafish larvae, which are even smaller and completely transparent, so you can look inside the brain without any surgical procedures. But today I will actually show you only data from the adult zebrafish olfactory system. So, about the olfactory bulb, the architecture of the olfactory bulb has been described in many textbooks. They are probably not complete, but I will just give you a brief rundown of the canonical connections within the olfactory bulb. Sensory neurons project to the outer layer, and axon terminals are converging in these glomeruli. And each of those many glomeruli in the olfactory bulb receives input from sensory neurons that all express the same odorant receptor. So we have a discrete array of input channels into the olfactory bulb. Then we have the principal neurons that receive direct input from the sensory neurons and also provide the output to multiple higher brain areas. These are the so-called mitral cells. And then you have two broad classes of inhibitory interneurons that connect the mitral cells. There are the granule cells in the deeper layers and the periglomerular cells in the upper layers. In addition, there are more cell types that I will not go into here. So just for the reductionist view of the olfactory bulb circuit, we have basically an array of vertical excitatory channels that are interconnected by two layers of horizontal inhibitory connectivity. So if you now present an odor to the system, it would activate a certain spectrum of odorant receptors and therefore evoke a pattern of input activity across this array of glomeruli, and this is then processed by this network. So in order to find out what is computed in this olfactory bulb, we a long time ago did experiments to first of all look at the patterns of input across to the olfactory bulb, and then look at the patterns of output across the array of mitral cells evoked by the same odors. Yes? It's true. There is a, this is actually not a synapse. This is a paracrine effect of GABA on GABA B receptors on the axon terminals. That's right. Okay, so to visualize these input patterns here, we did an experiment a long time ago where we loaded the sensory neurons here with a calcium indicator and then measured the presynaptic calcium signals within glomeruli that have been that are evoked by various odors. And for zebrafish, we can use amino acids, which are a natural class of odors for all essentially all aquatic animals. And then we see that each of those amino acids presented at an intermediate concentration gives a quite complex pattern of glomerular activation, and some of those patterns, like these ones, for example, are quite similar to each other, and other patterns are dissimilar from each other, and so on. So this is basically the input that the olfactory bulb gets. Now, to look at the output, we recorded first from the mitral cells, and then saw phenomena that have been described basically for olfactory, first order olfactory neurons in any organisms, invertebrates and vertebrates alike. And that is that the responses of these mitral cells show quite a rich temporal structure. So here, for example, we can see in this response a slow temporal patterning, first inhibition that is then followed by excitation. And then we see this faster rhythmic activity, which reflects synchronization among a subset, odor-specific subsets of cells in the olfactory bulb. Now, when we look at the population level, this is just an example of three mitral cells recorded sequentially in different animals, and we put them together in a hypothetical activity pattern. Then we find that that the responses of those cells to different odors are different and show also different dynamics. So, for example, this odor strongly activates this cell, but that then seems to adapt its firing rate. This one here responds with a little delay. Here, the same cell, three cells show another firing pattern. And now, what had been done before a lot was to analyze those firing patterns of individual cells over time. But what the system probably does is it takes within certain time windows, probably takes population activity patterns and analyzes those. So we therefore looked at how this population activity pattern changes over time. Right, so as far as we know, the zebrafish does not show any active sampling behavior, odor sampling behavior. So the odor would change either in a turbulent environment, but zebrafish usually spend most of their life actually in still waters or non-turbulent waters. So the fish will probably experience changes in its odor environment by active swimming. That is the idea. And the No, this would be just an analysis time window that we define. And we would then just move this analysis time window to later stages, and as you can just visually see here, we have a phase where those activity patterns change during the first few hundred milliseconds, but then they reach a stable state after a few hundred milliseconds.
What's the time scale over which an odor has to be presented, minimum time scale to get a behavioral response?
For a fish feeder, no. That's unfortunate. In other animals, there's a wide range of time scales. So rats and mice are actually very fast. They can discriminate odors within a few hundred milliseconds, 200-300 milliseconds. They take about 50 to 100 milliseconds longer for different discriminations, although there's quite a debate around this issue. Humans, for difficult odor discriminations, take up to 2 seconds, 1 to 2 seconds, something like that. So these are the data that we know. For fish, we do not know how long it actually takes. Yes? So one mitral cell is, in most cases, getting input only from one glomerulus, meaning one receptor. Oh, these ones, almost certainly, yes. These are random samples, randomly sampled mitral cells. No, they're almost certainly in different glomeruli. Yeah. Okay, so I should also say that our odor stimulus is not a step stimulus, but slowly increases over a few hundred milliseconds. So some of this initial dynamics may actually be produced by the increase in odor concentration at the early phase. Yes, the odor is on in all our experiments for 2.5 seconds. So it's on until the end of this, yeah. Run? Yeah, right. Okay, so then we look at these population vectors in successive time bins, and to just visualize them, we can basically sort them by intensity, wrap them around a point, and then get a pattern that our visual system can easily digest. And then we can do this for successive time steps and see that this pattern of activity actually changes. But it's nothing obvious that came to us from just looking at the patterns like this, at least at a single pattern. What we can then do is take a look at the pattern evoked by another odor that is very similar, chemically very similar to the first one, order the cells in the same way, and then we see early on that the pattern is actually quite overlapping and the correlation is high. This is not surprising because also the... Yeah, okay, so this is just a visualization. So we each pixel here is representing a mitral cell. Color code represents the firing rate in this time bin. And then we ordered them so that for this odor in the very first time bin, the cell that shows the highest firing rate is in the center, and the firing rates decrease from the center out. We did this because there was at that time, this was 10 years ago, so there was a suggestion that weakly responding cells will become suppressed, and the strongly responding cells will actually become enhanced or not suppressed during an odor response, so that you get a contrast enhancement similar to what you would get in the retina. So in that case, we should see a narrowing of that peak here, but that's not what we saw. So what we actually saw was something that did not make a lot of sense when we just look at one pattern. Now, when we compare this to the response of the same neurons ordered in the same way to a similar odor, we see initially this high overlap, and that's consistent with the glomerular response with the input, because these two odors would also evoke very similar glomerular activation patterns. But then over time, we see a dynamics here that follows a different trajectory. So those patterns diverge over a few hundred milliseconds, and as a consequence, their representations become decorrelated within the olfactory bulb.
Mm-hmm.
For these displays, this is just to visualize. We normalize each of those to the maximum activity. That's right.
Is the correlation normalized?
Well, the correlation anyway normalizes by the standard deviation. Yeah. So all the correlations I will talk about is the Pearson correlation coefficient, which is normalized by standard deviation. And all the effects I'm showing you here are not rate effects. Actually, some go opposite to what you would expect from a firing rate effect.
The right one is the one that fires the most TYR, right?
Yes.
And this also fires the most to PTRP?
That's right. In the first time bin,
and
yes.
On the first eight the squares around are the neurons that fire below that, but the most after that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's no difference between within this strip. Is there a difference between the one on the right to the white one, on the left to the white one?
You mean these two compared to these two up there?
Yes, but is there any reason why one is on the right, one is on the left?
No, it's just arbitrary arrangement. We arranged it, we wanted to have a pattern that is very simple for a visual system to detect, and especially where it would be simple to detect changes sort of in the tuning width of the population response. Okay, so this is just here an example for this one order pair, and we did this for a variety of, so for 16 different amino acids, and some of those are chemically similar to each other, and then you see here in this correlation matrix, correlation coefficients are color-coded, that you have here a bunch of amino acids that give similar patterns early in the odor response. Here's another group that gives similar patterns here, and so on. And then if we follow this correlation coefficients over time, what we see is that essentially all the high correlation coefficients decrease. In fact, it's not all. There's one correlation coefficient here that stays up, and it turns out that this fish line here cannot discriminate exactly this odor pair. Yeah? We looked at this. I will not talk about it. The short answer is that each individual cell would respond to the binary mixture basically in a fashion as if only one or the other odor would be present. And a priori, it's not possible to predict which odor will dominate over the other one. It's an interesting effect. We don't understand it completely, but the observation is quite clear. Mm-hmm. Pardon, this one?
Yeah.
Oh, no, this is now a correlation coefficient matrix. So here the pixels are not neurons. This fish line here, a bit more detail. This was done on wild-type fish that we got from a pet shop. And on another set of wild-type fish that we got from another pet shop, we found that those fish could not discriminate this odor pair. But they could discriminate almost all the others, with one exception that was a pair that gave weak responses in general. Then we have a laboratory line, an inbred laboratory line, and found that this inbred laboratory line actually decorrelates these two patterns. So we sent those out to our collaborators. This was Tine Valentinčič, who did the behavioral experiments, and he found that this inbred laboratory line can actually discriminate this odor pair. So there's some correlation between the decorrelation here and the ability to discriminate odors. Right. Yeah. We don't know exactly why this happens, but yes, they would be. They are significant. That's right. But not. But the. Pardon? There are two ways. We can do a few multiple presentations. That's difficult, though, because we cannot present too many odors here, but we can take subsets of neurons, repeat the analysis on those subsets, and then see if we get consistently the same effect. And we do. So this is actually something that we consistently observe. The correlations that start out near zero, or some are even negative, they actually slightly increase. And the correlation coefficients converge towards something like around 0.3 or so. Okay, so this phenomenon, decorrelation, was something that we thought interesting. Maybe one sentence about what it could be good for. It should be clear that the decorrelation does not increase the amount of information in those population responses, because you could just average over time, and then you would decrease your noise levels, and that would give you more or less the maximum amount of information that you can gather. But what the decorrelation does is it separates the representation, so it is easier in principle for a downstream decoder to discriminate between patterns using a simple classifier. And we think that this may be, this sort of easier access to the information may be what the decorrelation is good for. For example, there are the hypotheses that those activity patterns are stored in auto-associative memory circuits that can do pattern completion. And for those pattern completion mechanisms to work, the items that have should be stored must not be too similar, otherwise the pattern completion would be confusing various items. So we think of this as a pre-processing step that facilitates further processing downstream. Okay, so then we wanted to get a closer view of this decorrelation. The data I'd shown you so far were recordings from individual neurons, usually obtained in different fish and all pooled together. So the first step would be to look at those decorrelations in many mitral cells that we can measure in the same fish. And in order to get at this, we then used two-photon calcium imaging. And we do the calcium imaging basically in order to get the firing rate information back. And then we thought we could perhaps use a simple approach to reconstruct the firing rate from a measured calcium signal by deconvolution. So the experiment we did was we recorded extracellularly in juxtacellular configuration, actually, from individual neurons, and made them fire in some way. So this would be the firing rate curve. And at the same time, used two-photon imaging to measure the somatic calcium signal from the same cell. And you can immediately see that the time course of the calcium signal does not reflect the time course of the firing rate. That's not a surprise. In fact, a very simple model would propose that that each spike evokes an asymmetric calcium transient. And this time course of the calcium signal could then perhaps be represented as a convolution of the individual spikes with these asymmetric unitary calcium transients. So if this effect can account for most of the time course of this calcium signal, then we can just use a deconvolution to recover the firing rate information. And in fact, for this particular cell, that worked really well. So this came a bit as a surprise to us at the time. Then we quantified this for various different types of cells and also various different types of stimuli, and found that we can get something between 75% and 80% or so percent of the variance from a spatial-temporal firing pattern of the recorded cells back if we do this, if we look at the deconvolved calcium signal. So 82% we got when we used the perfect kernel for each cell. Perfect means the time constant and the amplitude was adjusted. This is not a realistic situation when you want to do population calcium imaging, because you cannot record from each cell afterwards and measure the kernel. So if we just take the same kernel for all the cells, we still get 74% of the variance back. So this is then how we use this method in order to look at odor-evoked calcium activity patterns. So we have our factory bulb here, use a two-photon microscope. Then we usually use transgenic fish lines that express a green fluorescent marker in some cell types, in that case mitral cells, for example. Then we load the tissue by bolus loading with a red fluorescent calcium indicator, ROCK2. And then can apply odors and measure calcium signals and assign those calcium signals to the cell types that we have marked up there. Then we can use the deconvolution to reconstruct the firing rate changes and end up with spatial-temporal activity patterns like this. The temporal resolution using the settings that we normally have is on the order of, it's either 128 or 256 milliseconds. Okay. So now we used this method and looked at the decorrelation again. Now looking at mitral cells here, all recorded in an individual fish. So this is the response of those mitral cells to that same odor, and that is a response to the similar odor. And then we find that, again, that this response is actually quite overlapping initially, and the overlap decreases over time, and that is seen here. The overlapping cells would be marked in dark colors, and the overlap decreases as a function of time. We also observed that the overlap is actually usually highest in a bunch of cells that are spatially clustered and so on, but I will not go into this today. Okay, so much for for the observation of decorrelation. And now I would like, in the rest of the talk, to do two things. One is I would like to present a theoretical study that identified a mechanism, a quite generic mechanism, that can produce a decorrelation like this. Yes? Yes, so each individual stimulus here would activate multiple types of receptors. And that's why you get activation of a combination of glomeruli, yes. In fact, we don't know if the mouse has shows the decorrelation at all. You would expect that in a mouse it should probably happen all within a theta cycle or so, because the sampling and representations in mice are heavily chopped up in time by the theta cycle. And it's, pardon? It could, yeah, it's actually true, yeah. Yeah. Now that you're saying it, it's true. Nobody really knows what happens to the firing patterns when the mouse engages in fast sniffing. Some people say that then the mitral cells actually stop following the theta rhythm and fire more in what looks like a continuous pattern. But then, yeah, so it's unclear over what time scale it should happen, but from behavioral results, you would think within a few hundred milliseconds. One to 300, maybe 400 milliseconds. For simple discriminations, roughly 300. For difficult discriminations, roughly 400 milliseconds. And about 100 milliseconds have to be subtracted for sensory and motor processes.
This would have been done at room temperature.
Yes.
So you might have
a temperature. Right, but the zebrafish live at room temperature slightly above, so 3 degrees above room temperature, yeah. Repeated representation of the same odor do not decorrelate, no. We'll come to that. That will be the second part of the talk, so there we'll go beyond this phenomenon of decorrelation and look at the dynamics and phenomena in a little more detail.
And there's the time scale of the, you showed the firing rate profile of one cell for the non-machine. It seems like more or less the firing rate was reducing in time. Is that common? And can one explain that this time
No. It's true. The population firing rate actually changes not very much. It is quite high at baseline, 8-9 hertz on average. Then it increases to something like 12 hertz and then slowly goes down back to 8-9 hertz. So within 1,000 milliseconds, it would reach peak maybe after 400 or so milliseconds and then go down back to base, then keep up over 2 seconds or so, which is the duration that we present the odor. So, but the population firing rate really does not change a lot. But individual cells show highest firing rate changes during the early period. And after that, the variance across the population in firing rate changes drops dramatically. So the peak firing rates, but only in few cells, we find at the earliest time periods. So what we did is we looked at which cells contribute most to the correlation of patterns, and how then do those responses change over time. And we found that most of those cells that contribute to the high to the correlation here and then to the decorrelation are cells that initially fire strongly in response to that stimulus, but then that same cell would maintain a pretty high firing rate in response to one odor, but the firing rate decreases in response to the other odor. And that's what accounts for most of the decorrelation. So therefore, and we also did pharmacology and the results are consistent, therefore we think that active inhibition, odor-specific inhibition of those mitral cells that get a lot of input can account for this decorrelation.
Is there decorrelation of the
nothing that we can observe. So the glomerular responses we measure also with calcium imaging, as I showed you, and we observe absolutely no decorrelation in the glomerular responses. Yes. So any of those dynamics that I showed you here is not observed at the level of glomeruli, and also not when you record from the sensory neurons in the nose. More than two odors pairs? Yeah, so with this method, we repeated the same experiments using the same battery of 16 odors and basically got the same results. All of them decorrelate, yeah. Not in this data set, because this was done in this laboratory line, which I told you about, where we saw all the patterns decorrelate. The only observation that we had with no decorrelation was this other odor pair that I showed you. And we have some other examples that I will show you later during the talk, but these are not different odors. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for fish, it's unclear how long they take. Well, in mice, yeah, as I said, simple odor discriminations take about 300, difficult odor discriminations 400 milliseconds in highly overtrained mice. In humans, right. Mm-hmm. Could be, yeah. In humans, actually, it takes much longer. So humans take maybe 500-600 milliseconds for easy discriminations, or 400 to 600, and difficult discriminations 800 to 2,000 milliseconds. But pardon? And I didn't. It is not increasing information? Well, as I said, for fish, we don't know. Afterwards, the information may be used for something, maybe learning or so, but it's unclear. I mean, all the experiments that have been done used learning as a method to obtain some readout from the mouse. So all of those animals had undergone heavy learning experience, and that's one thing. The other thing is that, as I said, during the first about 500-600 milliseconds, our stimulus is still increasing in concentration. So part of the dynamics here, part of the reason why it reaches a steady state after about 400 milliseconds, 500. It's mostly 400, maybe because the stimulus is not stable. If you would be able, so far we haven't been able to create step stimuli using small tubes in high viscosity media. If you would be able to do that, we would expect that the whole dynamics actually is compressed in time for various observations, but we don't know for sure. Okay, so. Now, Martin Wiecher, the mathematician in the lab, asked, how can networks with an architecture like the olfactory bulb produce a decorrelation of patterns like this? And maybe first, one slide on the kind of decorrelation we are looking at. So you can have a decorrelator, of course, and decorrelation has been studied quite a bit, but most of the studies concerned with decorrelation were looking at the correlation between channels in here. So each of those channels may get a time-varying input, and those may be correlated to some extent. And the decorrelator should then produce outputs where the individual channels are no longer correlated or less correlated. And for these kind of channel decorrelation mechanisms, we have quite a good understanding. Yes? No. So we measure two things here. One is the calcium signals from the glomeruli, And the other is the spike trains from sensory neurons in the nose. And both signals follow very stereotyped time courses. So all the different units and responding to different odors all follow the same time course, which is going up and then adapting slowly. Right. If you would look at the same correlation matrix for the same odors, but responses from receptor neurons or glomeruli, the correlations would just stay the same over the same period of time. Yes, almost the same time course. Okay, so those channel decorrelation mechanisms have been explored quite a lot. For example, you can use principal component or independent component analysis to do that. And that gives you results that can be directly related to neuronal networks. They give you results where you would get a decorrelation of these output channels, and the coefficients would tell you basically how you should connect up the neurons in order to get that. Now, what we are looking at here is pattern decorrelation, and that's a different issue. So using the same approaches, you can basically not get any results that would relate to a neuronal network in a straightforward way. And so what this channel decorrelation would achieve is something that is called efficient coding, where you can transmit a certain amount of information with a minimal number of neurons or information channels. And that's been looked at a lot. We have heard about this in previous talks. Now, pattern decorrelation does not necessarily reduce the number of channels that you have here or use them efficiently, but it would create patterns that become more decorrelated from each other, and therefore it is easier to retrieve information from those patterns afterwards. It's not more information in there, obviously, but it's easier to retrieve it. And for such mechanisms, we found actually very little in the literature. And those mechanisms that were present there were all adaptive. Adaptive meaning you had to know your inputs in order to train a decorrelator to decorrelate those inputs. But in fact, you can mathematically show that any linear operation on those inputs would, on average, not achieve a decorrelation if you would apply it to arbitrary sets of inputs. Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe we can talk later about it, yeah. Okay. And as I mentioned, those theoretical strategies at least have no obvious neuronal implementation. So what Martin Wiechert then did was first he started with a very generic mathematical approach. And he first looked at a set of neurons, at a network that actually at the initial state was not really a network because they were not yet connected. So it was just a threshold linear operator here. So all he did was basically thresholding the pattern. And then he looked at input patterns that were Gaussian distributed and bivariate normal. And you can see here, he could then introduce an amount of correlation between those patterns that he determined, and then got those thresholded. And then he observed something that actually Alex Rice had shown before, that if you threshold this, you invariably get a decorrelation. So he got a mathematical proof for that, just following what Alex Rice's lab did. So that was not very surprising. But if you look at this, the amount of decorrelation, so this is the input correlation versus the output correlation. So here you get decorrelation, and the effect becomes stronger as you increase the threshold. That's, again, been known before. But that would also mean that the number of, or the fraction of neurons in your output population would decrease because most of them are just thresholded to silence. And in order to get some substantial decorrelation, you would silence a lot of neurons. So in neuroscience, this would only make sense in networks that are very, very large. Yes? Well, no, what? No, what you do is you threshold the signals and then measure their correlation. So some of those will just be zero, and otherwise they will be the same as in the inputs. And then you get various different cases. So you get here these Dirac peaks. Here it's zero, and here you can just compute the normal correlation. We can discuss this maybe later. Okay, so this biologically is maybe not very plausible. No, this is all done here in a steady state. Yes, totally static, has nothing to do with dynamics at this point. Okay. So then the step forward compared to Alex Ray's work that Martin then took was to look at this effect in recurrent networks. And then he found that actually, and could show mathematically, that this recurrent feedback amplifies this threshold-induced decorrelation. And it can be negative or positive feedback. Except there cannot be too much positive feedback because he looked only at networks that converge to a stable state. So if you have positive, you also have to have negative feedback in order to keep stability. We'll come to that. In most cases, they're actually not very sparse. I'll say something about it. He's looking at firing rates, so at analog signals here, and they really converge to a stable state in the kind of networks that he considers here. So he considers analog neurons, rate signals, and the only nonlinearity is this threshold nonlinearity here, but mathematically this is a problem. Right. We'll see that. So in fact, when you turn on a signal abruptly, it goes through a dynamic phase, but then at t to infinity would converge to a stable state. Yes. What can you say? Yeah. So we have the this is the output activity pattern. Is this then the input at a given time, which is actually constant. And then we have the connectivity matrix here. That's this connectivity. And this is the activity here again. And this is the threshold. And this is thresholded.
So,
yes. Pardon?
And A is also
vector. A is also vector, same size as this. Maybe we actually, I would really like to get to the experimental part, and we, if possible, we can. Exactly. Yeah. That's up to definition. If possible, we can discuss this later, right? Because I would like to get through this. Okay, but what you see here now is that the red points are the decorrelation achieved by those recurrent architectures. And then different points, because this has been computed for networks with different parameters, such as density of synapses and other parameters, strength of synapses. So then you see that some of those can actually achieve decorrelation with much less sparsening of the output. So this is a log scale here. And then Martin went to look at more in detail into the properties of those networks that are necessary in order to achieve a strong decorrelation with little sparsening. And then he found, again, could show analytically, that decorrelation is enhanced by two network properties. One is sparse connectivity, and the other one is a high baseline activity in a certain coupling regime, at least. And this is actually a bit surprising, because we knew that a high threshold in a feedforward network, a high threshold promotes decorrelation. Here it's actually a low threshold, which then gives you high baseline activity. Okay. And then he verified those simulations. Basically, the underlying assumption was binormal input distributions and just this threshold and an infinite number of randomly connected neurons. So he verified this theory against simulations, where he just took 10,000 neurons and could find that the theoretical predictions were actually in excellent agreement with the simulation results. Okay, so then Martin wanted to know if this generic, it's a very generic strategy, because all you need is a threshold nonlinearity that is given in all neurons, almost all neurons, if this could contribute to the decorrelation that we observed in the olfactory bulb. And in order to do that, what he wanted to do was to construct a model that is more realistic model of the olfactory bulb and see if that effect actually works in this model. And in order to do that, he needed to know a bit more about the connectivity between neurons in the olfactory bulb, because we knew that this is, in some way, it's definitely non-random, and in some way dependent at least on spatial distances and probably on other things as well. Mm-hmm. Pardon? No, I'll come to this, but here it's any random connectivity matrix. We assume random connectivity simply for the lack of better knowledge. So in the future, that's why we do this connectomics and things. We would like to have connectivity matrices that are more realistic and most likely not random. Exactly, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Well. Maybe a theoretician would be happy with a random matrix, but a biologist like myself, not. So okay. So then Martin had a problem to measure to get a little more information about the connectivity and especially the distance dependence of connectivity, and this was addressed by another student in the lab, Benjamin Yudkiewicz. So what he did is. He used a method he called forward optical probing that combines patch clamping a mitocell here with measuring calcium signals from the possible follower neurons. So he patch clamped this genetically identified mitocell and then looked at calcium signals after loading the olfactory bulb with this calcium dye in response to strong current injection. So he drove. The calcium is in all indicators in all cells. Bolus loading. He's looking at all layers, and pardon? Including microcells. That's a genetic marker, so a fluorescent protein expressed in microcells. So he could target the microcell with a patch pipette, so that he knows he stimulates a microcell. And then he wants to get potential calcium signals from any other any cell type, microcells, but also others.
Also, yeah.
And in fact, he saw responses to this current injection only in inhibitory cells. Two exceptions, and these were microcells projecting dendrites to the same glomerulus. And it's quite well known that those are coupled by gap junctions and also by by excitatory glutamatergic coupling. But those cells that were not connected to the same glomerulus were all inhibitory interneurons.
What's the space scale here on the graph on the right?
Here? It's the same as this.
20 microns.
Yeah, so the whole field was...
20 by 100 microns.
Yeah, so it's... that's right. Here, this is the curvature of the olfactory bulb. So he looked at a field of view of about 250 to 300 microns. And the diameter of the olfactory bulb is about 400 microns in fish. So he could see basically one hemisphere, if you want. And outside that hemisphere, so towards the edges of his field of view, he saw not many cells.
Yeah, but I was just putting in the cloud of points up there, the cloud of cells.
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
Oh, this is actually the dendrite of the mitral cell where the current was injected. So this is the dendrite. And here you could then see some follower cells.
Can you say what fraction of those granule cells were labeled with Rho2?
As far as we can see, all of them. Yeah. Okay. So then he identified those follower cells here and just projected them on a sphere and measured the probability of finding such a follower as a function of the distance. And as the distance, he measured the distance on the surface of the sphere, which would then basically translate in a distance of number of glomeruli, if you want. And then, so on that distance scale, one glomerulus would be 20 microns, so within the first distance bin here. And then he found that the distance, the probability actually decreases with the distance, could be fit with an exponential. And the length constant of this was significantly larger than a single glomerulus, but it's not a random all-to-all type of connectivity. Yeah. Yeah, so from... Absolutely. So from previous experiments, we know that we need a spike in the postsynaptic cell to see a calcium signal. One is probably enough. So we could detect single spikes with a very high probability, above 90%. But it's true. So this is probably chopping the tip of the iceberg, because weak connections that never lead to spiking in a connected cell would not show up in this analysis. That's a caveat.
The odor concentration.
Pardon?
If you increase the odor concentration.
Oh, this is current injection here in the mitral cell. That's not odor stimulation.
Mm-hmm. So, you know when you're in a microcell.
Mm-hmm.
Other.
So we know only if it's a microcell or not,
yeah.
And we get only some rough information about the others from the depth of their position.
Yeah. So are you trying to stimulate microcells or any cell?
No, we stimulated only microcells.
Looked at any cell.
At any cell.
Any cell that was labeled.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you know which of those are microcells. Like, they're not microcells, you don't know which.
Exactly. And in fact, none of those, with these two exceptions of sister mitral cells from the same glomerulus, none of those were mitral cells. All of these were interneurons. And So from that, we would think that the output of the mitral cells really goes exclusively to interneurons, with the caveat that we may not detect all connections using this method. So using this method, the overall connection probability that we had was actually very low, sparse connectivity. As I said, this is probably an underestimate, maybe a severe underestimate, but others, anybody I think who tried to, maybe Ben can tell you, who tried to record connected mitral granule cell pairs is having a very hard time. So it seems that this connectivity is quite sparse. How sparse it really is, we cannot quantify from this, but what we quantified here is the probability of connections as a function of distance. Not with calcium imaging. But with calcium, it's hard to detect spontaneous activity, to know what is spontaneous activity and what is noise. And we have not recorded from those granite cells. We have done a few recordings, and there was actually very little spontaneous activity.
Mm-hmm.
So size of a glomerulus in that region would be about 20 microns. So the length constant would correspond to 5 glomeruli.
So I'm not sure about
Not really. This could be used for prediction or so, but yeah. No, as far as I know, there's no data on that. Yeah. So we then use this quantification here. There are about 1,500 mitral cells and 20,000 inhibitory cells altogether. So it's about 1 to 15 or so. OK, so then Martin used those data to. Pardon? I just feel I'm running out of time. That's OK, so. So he made a model then where he used again those analog threshold linear neurons, connected them directly by inhibitory connections using this distance dependent probability function. He used reciprocal symmetric connectivity to implement some features of the olfactory bulb, right? And then used actually the measured inputs that I've shown you in one of the early slides as inputs. So he now has the topographic representation included in his model, at least to some extent. In the inputs, it's directly the measured data. In the connections, it's this probability function.
So you say directly measured data, that was the calcium response of the terminal?
Yes. Yeah. And then he looked at the performance of this model, quantitatively compared the outputs to various different measured parameters. And these were many more parameters than parameters in the model to adjust. So he found that this then actually gave a very good match compared to measured data. And some of those are single neuron properties, others are pattern properties. And this is not a trivial result if he uses. Yeah. Maybe we should, let's talk about this later. This is just to verify that the model is not totally off the realistic. Well, if we don't use the naturalistic inputs, we cannot compare it to measured data because we don't have. Well, this is what we then explored. This is coming next now. So this is then the correlation, an average correlation in the output as a function of time, taking only the highly correlated input patterns. And then we can play exactly that game. So the first, what we then did is to obliterate any topographic relationships by randomizing inputs and connections. And then the decorrelation was slightly lower, but not a lot. So any topographic mechanism that had been proposed is, at least in this model, does not have a strong influence here. But now Martin could use that model to test if this recurrent threshold-induced decorrelation can account for it, because the predictions would be that if he gives up sparse connectivity and if he gives up the high baseline firing rate, then the decorrelation should decrease. And this is, in fact, what he saw. So with more densely connected networks, the decorrelation is almost completely gone. And also with when he sets the firing rate to zero, baseline firing rate, you get a strong reduction. So that shows us that this generic mechanism that Martin identified theoretically seems to play a substantial role in the decorrelation in this olfactory bulb-like but highly simplified model.
Is there an optimal firing rate, or does this get better and better with the firing
rate? It plateaus out at some point. Yeah, and there are other reasons why the firing rate should not become infinitely high, of course. Neurophysiological reasons, also the downstream areas may not tolerate too high firing rates. So it should probably not become too high.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on how many questions you're going to ask in the future. Yeah.
And then what is the non-topographic?
The non-topographic has the same number and strength of connections, but allocated randomly, completely randomized.
Over the entire bulb.
Over the entire bulb, yes. He also has looked at changing the length constant of this connectivity in some detail. And looked. So this is all in the paper. If you're really interested, that would be there. Okay, so just to summarize, what Martin identified here is a very generic mechanism that decorrelates patterns, not channels, but patterns. And this is doing something that, to my knowledge, other networks have not been described to do. So we know that the nervous system can decorrelate patterns, or at least we think it can, because when you look at these two input patterns, our visual system can immediately discriminate some differences between those. But that is because our visual system has been trained through evolution and experience to analyze phases. So if we just shuffle the pixels in these patterns, we get random pixel patterns that contain the same information, but now we are basically unable to discriminate those, or we would take a very, very long time. So what Martin's method would do now is it can deal with any kind of input patterns, and on average gets a decorrelation for those. And we think that those glomerular activity patterns are not as, or their statistics at least, is not as predictable as that of visual inputs, for example, or other sensory inputs. And therefore, such a more general decorrelation mechanism may be useful for the olfactory system because those patterns are less predictable. Okay.
It does this by translating spatial patterns into a temporal.
Well, for all of this analysis, basically the time course has not been analyzed at all, because the analysis was all done on the steady state. Okay, so. It's actually well behaved when for noisy patterns. It's not a chaotic thing. It's actually shown here. This is again the output versus correlation versus the input correlation, and you see for very highly correlated inputs, the amount of decorrelation you get is low, and the major decorrelation you get in this intermediate regime, and that also told us that. Now this theory is, as I said, done for randomly connected infinitely large networks. But this behavior here could easily, you could think of, be transformed in something that can do a classification, meaning that if you have families of inputs that are similar to each other, that they are not decorrelated, but if there is a certain difference between patterns, that then they become decorrelated. And that brings us basically to the second part now, where Jörn Niesing in the lab looked at basically this question, that sometimes sensory representations should be stable and tolerate differences in input patterns, but in other cases not. So in this decision making, this is obvious. Sometimes we update our information, but not our decision. We stick with our decision, and then there may be some additional information come in, and our behavioral output changes abruptly as we change our decision. That's obvious. But also in sensory processing, we have very often a generalization versus a pattern separation problem. So for example, again, our visual system, and this is probably happening in higher cortical areas, can recognize that this is actually the same guy, even though the retina gets very different input from those patterns. And at the same time, we can have a similar set for the retina is looking similar, but we immediately recognize that this is not the same guy. So that's sort of another universal problem here. And in olfaction, we have also some stability versus separation issue in the perception. For example, we know from psychophysics that if we apply an odor at different concentrations, then there's a limited range within which we identify that odor as the same stimulus. Even though the glomerular activation patterns in response to different concentrations of the same odor can actually vary quite a bit. At the same time, we know that in fish and in humans, we can apply a similar odor at a similar concentration, get a similar activity pattern, but perceptually, this can be discriminated. So this would therefore lead to the hypothesis, and that's what Jörn Niesing tested, that perhaps those representations already in the olfactory bulb are sometimes stable against changes, particularly in concentration, and sometimes undergo these abrupt transitions, that is the decorrelation. So Jörn then used the same method again and measured responses to different concentrations of the same odor. This is just raw data, time averaged. And then looked at the responses of mitral cells. This is now color-coded the temporally deconvolved calcium signal, so this reconstructed firing rate, in response to several concentrations of the same odor, and a control odor that is different but similar. So that would be one of those that should be decorrelated from those. And then he finds some cells that are sort of behaving nicely, that start to respond at some threshold concentration and then response increases. But other cells show different behaviors. So this one here, for example, responds maximally at an intermediate concentration. And that is quite different from the glomerular responses. So they always follow monotonic dose response curves. Okay, so Jörn therefore decided to look at those responses again as patterns and compare their decorrelation. He did this with the correlation matrices that you've seen before, but it's at least more nicer to look at. I don't think necessarily more informative to look at this in principal component space. So he just takes this time series of population vectors and plots it in the first three principal components space, and then he sees that that those patterns go from a resting state, spontaneous activity, follow a trajectory, and then converge at this steady state here. Yeah. Oh, I do not remember, but it's actually relatively low. I would think maybe 30%, 20%. 18% or something like that. So the three together. Pardon? No. And if you do, yeah. So and the total variance covered by those is not very high. Pardon? Yeah. Okay. And now he can look at those trajectories in response to increasing odor concentrations, and then actually sees that one order of magnitude higher concentration still gives you a similar trajectory, two orders also. And only if you go to quite high concentrations, the trajectories start to diverge. So and the same phenomenon is seen in the correlation matrix analysis. So here he found, and that was one of the questions, he found a second example of inputs that actually do not become decorrelated within a certain concentration range. Okay, so then he asked, how come that these patterns are not decorrelated, but if you go to similar stimuli, you get a decorrelation? So let's do the fine-grained analysis here. And you go from one stimulus to a very similar stimulus, the same two that I showed you initially, I think, and you morph the stimulus into another through a series of intermediate concentration ratios. So these are sort of two concentration experiments overlaid, giving you a morph of one stimulus to another, and of course morphing of stimuli has been done in real life before. So what do you get then? And this is now again in principal component space, the response to the first pure order, and then he now goes through the morphing series, and the next stimulus converges to the same steady state. And then suddenly, before this gets boring, he actually gets a sudden transition, and the trajectories converge to another steady state. And so he does not get a gradual transition here, but an abrupt transition of these output patterns. Yeah. We haven't tried this. All the orders were randomly interleaved here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We don't know this. We assume not, because we wait for 3 minutes, which is a very long time, between those stimuli in order to avoid any adaptation effects. And all the experiments were done with randomly interleaved stimuli, so we have not explicitly tested for hysteresis effects. But we assume there's nothing. We have, for this data, we have not done any discriminant analysis or something like that. So we have not tried to classify the odors based on the patterns that we measured. This is just sort of purely visualizing the patterns in principal component space.
So how did exactly you find these principal components? Do you get them at first by doing one experiment, and then those are fixed for the rest of the trials? Or
no,
are they different for each?
We take all patterns from so responses to all stimuli at all time bins, combine them in one big matrix, and then extract the principal components from that. What? Which conditions? So this was this brain explant preparation that I mentioned. And an odor application was just as before, took about 600 milliseconds to reach peak, and then stayed on for about another 2 seconds. The trajectories do not go out to 2 seconds, because not much is happening after that time. And then we just measure the patterns. So obviously, in the steady state, there's a clear separation between those. We have done some analysis to get an idea of when during the dynamic phase would you be able to predict where the steady state would be, and that is actually quite early, already during maybe 200-300 milliseconds after stimulus onset for those ones. Okay, so this is now the correlation matrix analysis. Now, see, it gets fancier over the years. So early during the odor response, you now have high correlations everywhere, because already the individual odors are very similar to each other. Now, based on our previous data, we would predict that the pure odors should decorrelate from each other. Question is now, how is the transition here? And in fact, the pure odors representations do undergo decorrelation. And there's this very abrupt transition right here. So that is just another analysis giving you the same result. Okay, so this was done, as I said, with two orders that are very similar to each other, and we get one transition, abrupt transition from these patterns to these patterns. Now, then Jörn did the same experiment with other order pairs that are, pardon? Oh, because we know that at the level of glomeruli, the input patterns are highly correlated. This is, for us, basically the definition of similarity. We also know from behavioral experiments that the fish can discriminate those, but they take longer to learn this discrimination than orders that we consider simpler. Now, then Jörn went to order pairs that are somewhat more dissimilar from each other. And with this order pair, for example, he found now two transitions from one set of patterns that looks like the pure order one to another set of patterns that is evoked by the intermediate mixtures, and that is different from this pattern that is like pattern 2 and this pattern that is like order 1. So the intermediate concentrations now give you activity patterns that are distinct from both of the individual components. And that is, in fact, also consistent with psychophysical data from the olfactory system, that odor mixtures sometimes have a perceived quality that is different from any of the components. Okay. And then Jörn was interested in how this pattern transition actually looks like when you look at individual neurons. For example, in the hippocampus fields, Mayank will know this. There's data from John O'Keefe, where he morphed spatial environments one into another and then saw that the place cells in the hippocampus in his paradigm, but not in others, but in his paradigm, undergo a sudden transition from one set of place field responses to another set of place field responses. And almost all the place fields switch their response at the same transition point in this morphing series. So this seems to be a global switch in the activity pattern. Now Jörn looked at this and took those cells that responded to those two odors, so not all that he looked at measured, but those that responded, and then plotted changes versus the mean in the color code, where red is basically higher than the mean and blue is lower than the mean. So if now a cell undergoes a change in its response at this transition point in the population response, you should see a switch from red to blue or from blue to red. And in fact, most of the cells in that sample do not change their activity a lot at this transition point, but it's a relatively small subset, maybe 10% or so of those cells here, which means much less than 10% of all the cells in the olfactory bulb. So it's a small ensemble of cells that undergoes a coordinated change in its response, but it's nevertheless giving you effects that can easily be picked up by a very simple global correlation analysis. So it's salient enough to detect this with a simple classifier. And in order to show that it's really these 10% of cells that are responsible for this transition over here, he just eliminated them from the data set and looked at the correlation matrices, and the transition is completely gone. In the other case, where he saw two transitions, he finds that there's two partially overlapping sets of cells that undergo a response transition at the first transition point, and then an overlapping set of cells that changes response at the second transition point. Okay, so now this would be a summary, even though I think that this summary figure here is not quite appropriate. So this, so we find some cases, for example, when we vary concentration, where we get only slight changes in the output patterns, but no major separation of output patterns. In other cases, when we vary stimuli, for example, along the dimension of molecular identity, we get sudden transition points, and there seem to be unstable regions in the output space then separate the output patterns. That's our interpretation. And in other cases, when we morph through a larger distance in coding space, we can also get into areas of the output that that are not related to the individual input patterns here. So this has some obvious implications. For example, coding seems to be discretized in the olfactory system. But here it's important to notice that presumably the number of those output states is very, very high. So we would have a discrete but still a high resolution space to represent odors. And if you would morph odors to somewhat larger distances in in odor space, then I would predict that you would basically not see the discrete transitions anymore, because there are just too many. So this is a still a high resolution but discrete coding strategy. Within each of those areas here, there's obviously some issue that trades off noise tolerance versus resolution, and that could be something. If this is well defined, that could be something that helps the higher brain areas to classify odors. This can act as a sensory filter by making this, for example, less sensitive along some dimensions, such as odors, and more sensitive along other dimensions. So it can it's basically a sensory filter. And this is done by small ensembles, which means that the number of possible transitions that you can have in this network is really very, very large because it's only small numbers of neurons here. This has obviously a lot of connotations when you think about attractor networks. I'm not sure if, at this point, I think we cannot say if we can cast this into a framework of attractor networks. What I don't like about those representations here is the fact that this seems to like the representation is sort of falling down in this topographic landscape. And if you would take away the stimulus, they would stay there. This is actually not the case. So those states live only for the time of stimulus application. As soon as you turn off the stimulus, it goes back to some ground state. So a better representation would basically be to represent this landscape as a ceiling and then move the representations against the ceiling so that they fall back as long when you take away the order. It turns out that our visual system then does not recognize this as shapes anymore. Pardon?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm not exactly sure I know enough, but it sounds right to me, yes. Okay, yeah. But the information is also in the field in that case. So the odor is the field, if I understand correctly. It depends on you. So this is what I thought we must go through. Now we can go on if you want. It's true that there's recent data from insects in particular that the receptor neurons can actually show some dynamics, and that dynamics probably has an influence on the dynamics in the antennal lobe in that case, which is the equivalent of the olfactory bulb. At least under our stimulation conditions here, we did not observe a lot of dynamics in the receptor neuron responses. There is a little bit of dynamics. It's basically a chain spread in the response latency. Those cells that are activated more strongly have a shorter response latency. And we would think that this, if you would have an instantaneous increase in the stimulus concentration, that this would basically reduce to zero those differences. But under the conditions that we have here, it's true that some of the dynamics may come from those latency differences mainly. It's absolutely true. But this here would be looking at the steady states versus the dynamic phase, and the steady state is reached after about 400 milliseconds under our conditions. After that, you still have some additional dynamics, but it does not move far away from the state that you have after 400 milliseconds. Okay, so the applause means I should not go on, I guess. Well, I have more data, but it would be now about the next level of processing. So if you want to stop, this would be a good okay. No, actually, I have to leave tomorrow afternoon. So we can, yeah. So before you run away, the most important slide here. So you've seen data basically from Martin Wiechert, who's a mathematician, and Jörn Niesing. who did the work in the second part. And Martin's project was a collaboration with Hermann Rieke, who is at the Applied Mathematics Department at Northwestern. But it was really mainly Martin who did this. I think that was outstanding. I learned a lot from him.